content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is new, hot off the press, dated January 27, 2025, which is the date I am reading this to you. In bright red, of course, the front cover is bordered with the usual narrow white inner border. Time is in large block lettering, all caps, in red, superimposed upon a black background. A very short caption exists near the bottom of the page of this front cover. Jimmy Carter, 1924 to 2024. It's a pensive pose that President Carter has struck for this photograph. It's a profile of him. His hair is short and gray. He's wearing a dark, possibly black suit. It blends right in with the background. A white shirt, presumably. This is a black and white photo. And a striped tie. He has his hands, his palms together, with his chin resting on the longest of his fingertips. It looks like he could be praying or thinking or simply respectfully posing for the Time cover photograph. If I see a credit for that, I will tell you. And here it is. The photograph is by Yusuf Karsh, K-A-R-S-H. President Carter died at the age of 100, December 29. He appeared on 28 covers of Time. For stories that explored his unlikely rise to the presidency, brokering a Middle East peace treaty, galloping inflation during his term in office, and more. It does not give the date that the cover photo was taken. Moving inside now, inside the issue, that January 27 issue. It's the first issue for 2025 that I've been able to read to you, perhaps the first one published. The Brief, Our Burning World by Jeffrey Kluger. It's a blurry image here. I don't know if it's a photograph that's been intentionally blurred or if it's a piece of artwork. It shows a hacienda-style home, multi-leveled. In the background are trees, possibly a hillside. As I said, it's blurry. And in the farther background, a gray sky, and in the foreground, flames, yellow, orange, and red. Again, this is by Jeffrey Kluger, Our Burning World. It's long been established climate change turbocharges wildfires with drought, persistent heat, lightning storms, dried vegetation, all contributing to out-of-control blazes. That's just one reason a January report from the European Space Agency's Copernicus Climate Change Service came as such bad news. According to the release, 2024 was the first year global mean temperatures exceeded pre-industrial levels by 1.6 centigrade or 2.88 degrees Fahrenheit. That blows past the benchmark established by the 2015 Paris Climate Accord, which sought to limit future warming to well below 2 degrees centigrade in the 21st century, with a perfect target of 1.5 centigrade. Doing so would help limit the impact of a hotter planet. In Southern California, the report could be read by the light of a burning city. January 7 alone, four wildfires fed by 80 mile per hour Santa Ana winds roared across Los Angeles County, destroying thousands of homes and forcing tens of thousands to flee. But everywhere the earth is showing signs of heat swoon, with record high levels of water vapor in the atmosphere, record low expanses of sea ice around the poles, record oceanic temperatures in the North Atlantic, Indian, and Western Pacific Oceans. July 22, 2024, went into the books as the hottest single day ever recorded worldwide, with the average thermometer popping its top at a comparatively feverish 17.16 centigrade, 62.8 Fahrenheit. All of the global temperature data sets showed 2024 was the hottest year since records began in 1850, said Carlo Buontempo, a Copernicus director, in a statement. Wildfires across America were not only a result of climate change, but also a cause of future heat. Bolivia and Venezuela released record levels of wildfire-related carbon dioxide, also owing to fires. Canada reached its second highest annual output. If there was any good news to be found in the Copernicus report, it is that a single year that exceeds pre-industrial temperatures by 1.5 centigrade is not the end of the story. The Paris Agreement considers the 1.5 centigrade threshold formally breached only if that is the average temperature increase over a 20-year stretch. There's still time for aggressive climate action to lower emissions and bring temperatures to heel in the process. Now, as Buontempo pointed out, humanity is in charge of its own destiny. This page and a half include, next to the column written by Jeffrey Kluger, contains 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 photographs. They're easy for me to describe, not in detail, but because they're all conflagrated. They are conflagrations showing a dark city with bright orange and yellow fires encircling it, eating through it, burning housetops, burning homes with a fireman scurrying in front of it with a hose, something that looks like fireworks but is a palm tree bursting into flame, and then complete rubble in another photo where the flames are barely embers, but they left nothing discernible as homes or buildings or other premises. Turning the page now to another photo, half a page. Louisiana in mourning. At a vigil in New Orleans, January 4, Kathy and Louis Tenodorio grieved their son, Matthew Tenodorio, who was one of 14 people killed after a man drove a truck into a New Year's Day crowd. The attacker, killed in a shootout with police, was identified by officials as Shamsuddin Jabbar, a 42-year-old U.S. citizen and Army veteran from Texas. In the foreground, two people kneeling. Senior citizens, I would expect, since their hair is white, both the man and the woman's. He is dressed in dark clothing, perhaps dark blue jeans and a navy blue or black jacket. She is dressed in a dark colored pair of slacks with a blue denim jacket. They're both wearing glasses. They're both sobbing in front of what appears to be a shrine for these people who were killed. Flowers are strewn everywhere in front of quite a bank of candles, the votive type of candles, behind which is signage. And I don't know if it's graffiti on a wall or building or if there are posters involved, but these people are grieving. Andrew R. Chow writes this short article, Bulletin, Meta, M-E-T-A, ends fact checks, sparking concern about misinformation. Meta said January 7 it would abandon its fact-checking program in favor of a crowdsourced model that emphasizes free expression. The shift marks a profound change in how the company moderates content, raising questions about the implications for misinformation and hate speech. Meta, which operates Facebook and Instagram, had long funded fact-checking efforts in which third-party organizations like the Associated Press review content. These efforts aim to combat widespread documented misinformation campaigns on Facebook, especially around elections, but many Republicans chafed at the oversight, saying it amounted to policing political thought. Donald Trump wrote last year that CEO Mark Zuckerberg could spend the rest of his life in prison. After the election, Zuckerberg visited him at Mar-a-Lago. Announcing Meta would get rid of fact-checkers, Zuckerberg called the program too politically biased. Facebook will now rely on a community notes model championed by Trump ally Elon Musk at X, in which unpaid users rather than third-party experts police content. Meta also updated its hateful conduct policy, allowing users to refer to women as household objects or property and to transgender people as it. While Trump praised Meta's decision as good news, watchdogs and social media experts have voiced concerns. This type of wisdom-of-the-crowd approach can be really valuable, says Valerie Wirtschafter, a Brookings Fellow. But doing so without proper testing and viewing its viability around scale is really, really irresponsible. Meta's already having a hard time dealing with bad content as it is, and it is going to get even worse. Next page, the brief news. Good question. Bird flu could be the next big health risk. Where's the vaccine? This is by Alice Park. Now that the world has adjusted to living with COVID-19, a new infectious disease threat is looming, this time from wild birds. Highly pathogenic avian influenza, or H5N1 bird flu, is spreading among dairy cattle that provide our milk and starting to cause serious disease in people. An elderly man with underlying health conditions became the first to develop severe disease in the U.S. and died in early January, and a 13-year-old girl with asthma in Canada became so sick with H5N1 in late 2024 that she had to be put on a ventilator. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, maintains that the risk to the general public is low, since H5N1 does not generally cause serious illness in people. But these recent cases are reason for public health officials to prepare for wider outbreaks and a possible epidemic or pandemic. The key to that response will be an effective vaccine. The concern is that this virus could acquire the capacity to attach to human cells and spread widely. That would be opening the door to a new pandemic for sure, says Dr. William Schaffner, professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University Medical Center and spokesperson for the Infectious Disease Society of America. For that to happen, the virus would have to develop mutations that allow it to more easily infect human cells, a process that could be accelerated if someone were infected with both seasonal flu and H5N1, for instance, allowing the two viruses to exchange genetic information and recombine into a strain that spreads readily among people. Luckily, that has not happened yet, and we are not starting from zero when it comes to a bird flu vaccine. Here are the latest efforts to develop a new version. Is there already an H5N1 vaccine? Several vaccines target H5N1, and the national stockpile has doses of all of them. These shots focus on different strains of H5N1 that were circulating when the vaccines were developed years ago, but health officials expect they would still provide some protection against severe disease. A small number of healthy volunteers have been vaccinated with these shots, and the antibodies they generated appeared to neutralize the currently circulating virus in lab tests. But these vaccines have not yet been tested in large clinical trials. Since there have not been enough H5N1 infections in humans to compare vaccinated people with those who are unvaccinated. What about an mRNA vaccine for H5N1? There is not one yet, but several companies, including Moderna, Pfizer, GlaxoSmithKline, in collaboration with CureVac, are working on such a shot, based on the same technology behind the COVID-19 vaccines. In July, the U.S. government's Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, BARDA, B-A-R-D-A, awarded Moderna $176 million to develop its updated mRNA H5N1 vaccine. All of the mRNA vaccine candidates are in early stages of testing in people for safety and efficacy. The beauty of mRNA is the ability within a moment's notice to change the vaccine, says Scott Hensley, professor of microbiology at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, who helped develop such a vaccine candidate. How soon could an updated vaccine become available? While developing an mRNA vaccine would take just a matter of months, testing the shot in clinical trials would take longer. To avoid that delay, the National Institutes of Health is sponsoring trials of another type of vaccine that would target all of the different types of influenza. The idea would be to prime the population with this type of vaccine and buy some time for more specifically matched vaccines to be used as boosters, says Hensley. Schools wouldn't have to close down, and people might still be infected but not dying. Who should get vaccinated against H5N1? At the moment, there are no recommendations for anyone in the U.S. to get vaccinated against H5N1. Finland, however, has offered people at higher risk of exposure to bird flu, including those in the fur industry who handle wild boars, and people in the poultry industry, a bird flu vaccine that includes an inactivated form of the virus. It's one of the shots currently in the U.S. stockpile that could be used in case of an outbreak. Turning now to milestones. Let's see, there are only five categories in the small thumbnail sketches, plus an almost full-page article, well, not really full-page because there's a photo in it, with a sixth. Now, I'm going to read this sixth one to you first because it's the longest. Resigned. Justin Trudeau, Once Favorite Son by Stephen Maher, and Maher is the author of The Prince, The Turbulent Reign of Justin Trudeau. The photograph is of Justin Trudeau, a young-looking man with dark, wavy hair. I'm thinking either clear brown or blue eyes. He's wearing a blue suit, blue shirt, blue tie, seated in a black high-back chair. Behind him are two of the flags of Canada, the maple leaf, red and white. And behind the flags is a multi-paned window, behind which is a photograph of a city with framed by green trees and blue sky. Okay, Justin Trudeau had a special bond with Canadians who had known him since he was born. Christmas Day in 1971, the son of Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau. That bond helped him get his dad's old job. Trudeau had grown up in public, and he brought a welcome dose of glamour to the humdrum world of Canadian politics. With his election as Prime Minister in 2015, he managed to bring his Liberal Party a resounding mandate, an echo of the Trudeau-mania that gripped the country when his father won government in 1968. It was a restoration of the elder Trudeau's vision of Canada as a bilingual, multicultural, northern social welfare state, this time with more openness and fun. But after nine tumultuous years as Canada's leader, Trudeau was forced to announce his resignation January 6 to avoid a revolt from Liberal members of Parliament who are facing certain defeat in an election that will likely take place before the snow melts. Trudeau will stay on until his replacement is chosen, but he leaves his country in a perilous place. Canadians are not in the mood to separate his accomplishments as Prime Minister, which range from bringing in a carbon tax and legalizing marijuana to successfully managing the first presidency of Donald Trump and getting Canada through the COVID-19 pandemic. Trudeau managed those crises fairly well, though he created others, including a blackface controversy and a series of ethics scandals. What did him in, however, was the post-pandemic cost of living crisis. As with practically every other incumbent in the West, Trudeau's polling went underwater with household budgets. Economic growth has been slower in Canada than the U.S., and his mismanagement of immigration made matters worse. It all came to a head in December, after Trump threatened to impose ruinous 25% tariffs on Canadian imports. Trudeau flew to Mar-a-Lago, hoping his charm would win the day. Trump responded by threatening to annex Canada. With little support at home, Trudeau could not find a way to respond to the bullying effectively. For years, Trudeau had been telling anyone who would listen that he had to stay on to fight the next election against combative Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre, excuse me, French speakers, I'll spell it, P-O-I-L-I-E-V-R-E, whose right-wing policies and harsh attacks are outside the tradition of Canadian politics. Every bone in my body has always told me to fight because I care deeply about Canadians, he said in announcing his resignation. But he could no longer ignore the fact voters want someone else to wage their battles. And now from the short column named 19 people as Presidential Medal of Freedom recipients, including Hillary Clinton, George Soros, Irvin Johnson, Jose Andres, Bill Nye, Jane Goodall, Lionel Messi, Anna Wintour, and Denzel Washington, by President Joe Biden, January 4. Died Jean-Marie Le Pen, who founded the French far-right political party, the National Front, and was repeatedly convicted of inciting racial hatred, at 96, January 7. Launched congestion pricing in New York City, January 5. Most drivers going into central Manhattan now pay a $9 toll in an effort to cut traffic and pollution and raise money for public transit. Certified Donald Trump's election as president by Congress, January 6, at a U.S. Capitol his supporters overran 4 years earlier. Appointed the first woman to lead a major Vatican office by Pope Francis, January 6, Italian nun Sister Simona Brambilla will be prefect of the office that oversees every religious order in the Catholic Church. The brief business, a new page here, well, a new two pages here, subheading employment, title, The Colleges and Companies Shaping America's Leaders, by Jeremy Gantz, G-A-N-T-Z. Business is evolving faster than ever before, and companies are rethinking the path to the C-suite. Whereas in the past, aspiring leaders might earn their stripes by rotating through another part of the business for a year or two, today more top firms are constantly providing people with new opportunities, says Stefan Meyer, M-E-I-E-R, a professor of business strategy at Columbia Business School. To supercharge the pace of skill building, workers now have to change jobs more frequently. The ability to not only rapidly learn new terrain, but also guide teams in overcoming new challenges is becoming an indispensable leadership skill, Meyer says. This, in essence, is what global consultancies like Accenture and Deloitte are designed to do. No surprise, then, 5 of the top 10 best companies for future leaders in Time and Statista's new ranking are consultancies. The study analyzed the resumes of 4,000 top U.S. leaders in business, government, academia, nonprofits, and other sectors to see where they previously worked and studied. Compared with last year's list, that is twice as many resumes drawn from a wider range of fields and leadership positions. With 175 organizations now included, the new ranking offers a wide-angle look at the places today's top leaders are most likely to have spent at least some of their professional lives. The list of colleges most commonly attended by American leaders remains heavily tilted toward the Ivy League or similarly prestigious schools such as Stanford, MIT, University of California, Berkeley, and University of Chicago. Underscoring what University of Arkansas Associate Professor Jonathan Wai, or Y, W-A-I, calls a huge education divide in this country. On the list of companies, McKinsey & Company remains at number one. Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai, Citigroup CEO Jane Fraser, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg all once worked at McKinsey. At consulting companies, every client creates the possibility for somebody to have a leadership opportunity, says Scott Anthony, a professor at Dartmouth College's Tuck School of Business, who worked at McKinsey early in his career. They just teem with opportunities. So do large blue-chip companies, like consumer goods powerhouses Procter & Gamble and PepsiCo, he says. The top companies for future leaders have three things in common: ample leadership opportunities for younger employees, feedback cultures that help budding leaders improve, formal investments in leadership development. That's the connective tissue, Anthony says. But look at the top 20 slots on Time's list and a more complex picture of where top U.S. leaders emerge comes into view. For college, flagship, public university campuses from across the country, liberal arts colleges, historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, are all represented. The University of Pittsburgh, Howard University, the University of Hawaii system now rank in the top 50. The latter two institutions make their debut on the list this year. Among employers, the Smithsonian Institution, the World Bank Group, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, all government-affiliated, also show up for the first time. So does the nonprofit American Cancer Society. Strikingly, none of the country's big five tech firms, Meta, Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, are in the list's top 10. This probably relates to the relative youth of these companies, Anthony says. People are still making careers in these companies, he says, versus purposefully developing for a few years and then heading for the door. An exception is Microsoft, which is the oldest of the cohort, founded in 1975. It clocked in at number 11, up from 21 last year. Meta, Alphabet, and Apple also rose, signs that more alums of these companies are now spreading their wings in leadership. There are similarly early signs that recruiters are looking beyond the Ivies for potential leaders. Recruiters are casting a wider net, says Gina Cox, author and consultant who helps companies become more inclusive. But the shift is not yet visible in top-level leadership in American companies, Cox says. That will take years. Even as some organizations embrace more expansive recruiting approaches, demand for graduates of top-tier universities is not ebbing. Business schools at so-called Ivy Plus universities are still watching scores of freshly minted MBAs heading into the finance, tech, and consulting sectors, all top fields for producing high-profile leaders. In any given year, says Abby Scott of UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, 25% to 30% of our full-time MBA graduates join management consulting firms such as Deloitte, McKinsey, and PwC. Boris Groysberg, a professor at Harvard Business School, says that once graduates are in the workforce, climbing the ladder is now all about acquiring new skills. In the past, a linear path up the org chart to a top leadership post was the norm. Today, zigzagging and lateral movement between organizations is valued by many hirers as new technologies depreciate the value of existing skills. I have never seen so much focus on skills and skills development, Groysberg says. Companies are basically saying, where you worked 10 years ago does not tell me anything. What are the skills and capabilities you have now? In other words, tomorrow's top leaders will be lifelong learners who take flight by embracing new challenges. Now, there's a kind of a graph. It's really a two-column list, as far as I'm concerned, that Time has published. One is in blue, one is in green. The blue one is labeled Top 20 Best Companies for Future Leaders. I think I'll try to read all of these fairly quickly. The rank goes from 1 to 20, then the name, then the leadership score, whatever that is, and then the location. Okay, these are 20 best companies for future leaders. McKinsey & Company, 100, New York City. IBM, 93.02, Armonk, New York. Goldman Sachs, 91.15, New York City. Accenture, 90.69, New York City. Procter & Gamble, 90.09, Cincinnati. PWC, 89.55, New York City. PepsiCo, 87.69, Purchase, New York. Deloitte, 87.50, New York City. Bank of America, 87.47, Charlotte, North Carolina. Ernst & Young, 87.11, New York City. Microsoft, 86.97, Redmond, Washington. KPMG, 86.85, New York City. Alphabet, 86.62, Mountain View, California. J.P. Morgan Chase, 86.27, New York City. Johnson & Johnson, 86.22, New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, 85.76, San Jose, California. NASA, 85.45, Washington, D.C. ExxonMobil, 85.20, Irving, Texas. Mass General Brigham, 85.05, Somerville, Massachusetts. And 20, Citigroup, 84.97, New York City. Now, in the green column, the top 20 best colleges for future leaders. Again, 1 through 20, name, leadership score, and location. Harvard University, 100, Cambridge, Mass. Stanford University, 89.80, Stanford, California. Yale University, 85.34, New Haven, Connecticut. University of Pennsylvania, 84.64, Philadelphia. Massachusetts Institute of Technology, 84.55, Cambridge, Mass. Columbia University, 83.74, New York City. University of California, Berkeley, 83.45, Berkeley, California. New York University, 82.03, New York City. Princeton University, 81.95, Princeton, New Jersey. Georgetown University, 81.91, Washington, D.C. Northwestern University, 80.93, Evanston, Illinois. University of Michigan, 80.85, Ann Arbor, Michigan. University of Chicago, 79.82, Chicago. Cornell University, 79.38, Ithaca, New York. University of Virginia, 79.01, Charlottesville, Virginia. Dartmouth College, 78.92, Hanover, New Hampshire. University of Southern California, 78.57, Los Angeles. Brown University, 78.54, Providence, Rhode Island. University of California, Los Angeles, 78.42, Los Angeles. And number 20, Duke University, 78.28, Durham, North Carolina. From the World. This is a small column written by Chantel Lee. There's a photograph by Bilal Khaled, Khaled, showing someone on a ladder. I don't know if the person is hanging or removing a flag. The flag has horizontal stripes from top to bottom of green, white, and black with red stars. I see three. I don't know how many are in the flag. And this is either hanging or being hung or being removed from some very ancient-looking stone archways. Well, it's actually at one archway, but there are more shown in the photo. It's the light box. World. With the fall of the Assad regime, Syrians ascend. For 54 years, the Assad family ruled Syria, relying on the ruthlessness of internal security forces that imprisoned and killed more than 100,000 people and turned peaceful 2011 protests of the Arab Spring into a bloody civil war. The war ended December 8, when a militia once allied with al-Qaeda swept into a capital President Bashar Assad had fled for Russia. Busy fighting in Ukraine, Russia held back forces that had ridden to his rescue in the past, ditto a weakened Iran. Jubilant Syrians poured into the streets, waving the three-star flags, okay, that flag had three stars, of the Syrian revolution, throwing open the doors of the regime's most notorious prisons, making anguished searches of morgues and mass graves. Next came envoys from the U.S. and Europe, anxious to take the measure of Ahmad al-Sharaa, the leader of the insurgent coalition. He has promised a moderate and inclusive government. Palestinian photojournalist Belal Khalad, Khaled, made his way to Damascus in the wake of the revolt to capture the moment of freedom. December 20 found him at the entrance of the Umayyad Mosque, once the seat of the Sunni Caliphate, in time for Friday prayers. Khaled was struck by this scene because just days earlier, displaying that flag openly would have been unimaginable. "I look at this photo in an artistic way," he says, "that this man is using the ladder to go up to the future or to the sky and to the new Syria." The Brief Health. This is written by Angela Haupt. 5 questions to ask yourself at the start of a new year. The last of 2024 is in the rearview mirror. But before forgetting it ever existed, consider reflecting on everything good and bad and weird and inspiring that happened to you over the past 12 months. When we stop and stand and look back at where we have been and how we felt when we were there, it can serve as a blueprint for where we want to go forward, says Caroline Finkel, Chief Clinical Officer with the virtual mental health platform Charlie Health. By asking yourself a series of probing questions, you will become more self-aware and figure out how to make changes that can boost your happiness and well-being in the new year. Think of it as a gentle inventory rather than a high-stakes self-assessment, she adds. Where to start? Ask yourself who and what strengthens or drains you. These insights can help you better manage your energy. Finkel likes to regularly take inventory of what's adding a net positive to her life. For example, like taking care of the ducks in her pond. And what registers as a net negative, like spending too much time on social media. If something makes you particularly happy, do it over and over and over again. She says, more duck feeding for Finkel in 2025. Other examples include spending more time with the people who invigorate you and setting boundaries around those who zap your vitality. We also asked other experts to share what we ought to ask ourselves at the start of 2025 to make it our best year yet. 1. What brought me genuine joy last year? Take a moment to reflect on what made you happiest over the past year. Don't overthink it. Whatever pops into your mind was a peak experience, says Lauren Farina, a psychotherapist in Chicago. It reveals our truest, most authentic desires, beyond what we've been conditioned to believe we should be doing or what we are expected to be doing. Once you've landed on your happiest moments, brainstorm practical ways to integrate more of those experiences into your day-to-day life in 2025. 2. What positive qualities did I notice in myself in 2024? When people reflect on their year, they often tick off accomplishments like getting promoted at work. They reduce themselves to this one thing, and they are so much more than that, says Gabriel Morse, a licensed mental health counselor in New York City. What's so much more important are the qualities they are able to see in themselves. She suggests celebrating all the ways you have grown or shown strength and resilience or have been true to your authentic self. 3. How can I make peace with last year's problems? This is one of Farina's favorite ways to turn challenges into opportunities. Maybe something life-altering happened to you in 2024, and you will need to adopt a new mindset or communication strategy in order to cope. within a crisis or loss or trauma is an opportunity for you to grow, Farina says. Four, are my goals specific and attainable? Targeted goals can keep you on track, but vague ones can derail you. If you want to get in shape, for example, better to commit to working out for 30 minutes every morning than simply vowing to exercise more or burning yourself out with 3-hour gym sessions. You want something that's very specific and that you can actually do, says Dr. Ashley Zucker, psychiatrist with Kaiser Permanente, Southern California. And five, what would I do in 2025 if I were not afraid? Reflecting on what you would do if you were not consumed with worry can help expose the ways fear plays a role in your daily life. It is not that we should never make decisions out of fear, Farina says, but we should at least pause before defaulting to a fear-based choice. By reflecting on the ways that being afraid is holding you back, you might take a leap of faith in 2025 that changes the course of your year for the better. Well, I would say to this, good luck and good sense to all of us. From the back page of this edition of Time Magazine are the 8 questions. Let me count them here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, by Andrew R. Chow, Roy Wood Jr., the comedian on his new stand-up special, The Importance of Working in Food Service and Learning from Keanu Reeves. 8 questions in the question and answer format. First question, you used to do prank calls on the radio. How has TikTok changed prank culture? Answer, some prank culture now is short attention span theater. It is not well thought out. And they're out to make strangers look stupid, not themselves. If I didn't laugh and there was no inherent attempt at laughter, you were just being rude to someone. Why is your new comedy special on Hulu called Lonely Flowers? Answer, a group of flowers together is beautiful, but if you ever see a flower growing by itself, you go, oh, what happened? As a society, we all somehow turned into a bunch of lonely flowers. A lot of the places we used to be connected were at stores, in lines, in conversations with cashiers, and that's been replaced by touch screens, automated ordering, door dashing. You worked at the chain restaurant Golden Corral in college. What did you learn from that experience? Answer, I feel like every American should either serve a year in the military or 2 years in food service. Both will give you differing perspectives on society and how to treat people and how fortunate you are. When I started doing stand-up comedy, a lot of my jokes were 2 or 3 sentence greeting bits that I did earlier that day on shift. I could take a quick little observational joke and by the end of my shift have it worded in a way that it works on any demographic. You start noticing we do have a lot of things that connect us. That was a very, very special time in my life. Was the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2023 the toughest room you ever played? Answer, that dinner's tough because no matter what, you probably will only have half the room because half of them don't agree with the political lean of the joke or they're sitting with the person you're making fun of. But we don't have to worry about that for the next 4 years. I'm sure it'll turn into some Trump yard sale for all of his merch on C-SPAN. Does Trump winning make you happier or sadder that you weren't tapped to host The Daily Show? Answer, Trump's win or loss does not change our job as political satirists to jump down the throat of what government is and isn't doing right. I think the difference becomes figuring out a new way to get people who love Trump but ignore facts to pay attention to facts. If you still want to vote for him at the end of that analysis, cool, but there's been a big disconnect between what's considered entertainment and what's considered news, and the public no longer cares about the difference, so long as they are entertained. You are in Outcome, an upcoming film starring Keanu Reeves. What did you learn from him on set? Answer, he's one of the most tactical actors I've ever worked with. It was masterful to watch him ask questions. The fear is that if I ask the director something, he'll think I'm stupid. But that's not the case at all. You recently hosted the All-MLB Awards. What can baseball do to increase its cultural relevancy? Answer, encourage players to play with some flair. The World Baseball Classic gets great ratings, and it is this electric, festive atmosphere. Japanese baseball, that SH space T, is like a college football game. Let players bat flip. Let them pimp walk after they strike you out. And the last question and answer, in your special, you talk about the importance of understanding cycles of progress and backlash. What do you mean? Answer, the more we can remember history, the more we can look at what's happening now through a larger lens and be a little bit more predictive of what is coming. So the next time you make progress, then you know how to start building up your reserves to prepare for the backlash. Here's another list published by Time that talks about AI leaders. I think I'll have time to read just one column from this. AI Literacy for Workers, May Habib, H-A-B-I-B, is CEO of Writer, W-R-I-T-E-R. Layoffs and AI-fueled restructuring are making headlines, but companies that rush toward an AI-led future without bringing their employees along will find themselves at a disadvantage. Instead of cutting jobs, what if companies reimagined them? What if every employee were given the chance and tools to adapt their role alongside AI? The builders of tomorrow won't be who you expect. As AI becomes deeply embedded into our workflows, next-generation builders won't be just tech experts. They will be problem solvers, bold creatives, and strategic thinkers. They will come from across your organization, spanning operational leaders, design, and systems thinkers, and frontline users who can grasp AI's potential and turn it into real-world impact. With 40% of the workforce needing new skills in the next 3 years to keep pace with AI, leaders across the board will need to rethink how they build their teams. It will not be as easy as running a few training programs and hoping they stick. Building an AI-first workforce will require a deliberate, top-down shift across the entire organization. Leaders need to embrace change, challenge outdated processes, invest time and resources to help employees thrive. After all, AI systems are only as strong as the diverse perspectives behind them. When companies commit to this shift, the potential is unstoppable. Productivity, industry-defining customer experiences, breakthrough solutions to our most mission-critical problems. And I'll try reading one more that's short. Universal AI Inclusion. Bolor Erdin Batsengel, Batsengel, B-A-T-T-S-E-N-G-E-L, is former Vice Minister of Digital Development of Mongolia. AI has already become a driving force in healthcare, education, agriculture, and beyond. Yet its power is concentrated in the hands of very few people, leaving many developing countries and emerging markets excluded from its benefits. Right now, 2.2 billion people lack internet access, let alone AI tools. I would love to see AI education become as accessible as literacy. I want to see herders in the nomadic community of Mongolia using AI to predict weather patterns, or a small business owner in Peru leveraging AI to improve the efficiency of her business. I want to see young girls using AI for personalized education to pursue their dreams. This is not about technical skills or preparing the labor force in the tech industry. This is about encouraging communities to question biases in AI platforms, advocate for fair and inclusive technology, and build tools that align with their unique needs. Governments, tech companies, international organizations, and educators must collaborate to deliver localized, inclusive AI education programs, especially in emerging markets and underprivileged communities. Moving to yet another short column, invest in African talent. Ronit Avni, AVNI, who is CEO of Localized. African job seekers remain underutilized despite the presence of a growing, highly skilled talent pool. Employers often prefer to hire engineering and business talent from long-established tech hubs such as India, Poland, Israel, and the U.S. The number of companies actively seeking African talent remains far smaller than it should be, given the size of the eligible candidate pool. Yet persuading employers to change course is often an uphill battle. A wave of new job opportunities is emerging, however, with millions of roles expected to be created over the next few years. These positions, driven by new regulatory and reporting requirements on carbon emissions and environmental, social, and governance, ESG, compliance, affecting over a dozen countries from the UK to Singapore, currently lack established regional talent hubs. This shift presents an exciting opportunity for African candidates with green skills to leapfrog ahead and play a central role in the green talent revolution. Much as India has risen as a formidable engineering hub, Africa has the potential to lead the way in carbon and ESG talent. Achieving this will require strategic investment to build candidates' carbon intelligence now, while raising employers' awareness of this talent pool so that the continent can seize on this transformative moment. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.com. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.